interim basis, vowing to take as much time as necessary to find a dynamic young architect that fit their vision for the team. Kerrigan lasted only 2 weeks into spring training, the owners waiting until their purchase was closed in February. Lucchino called a team meeting one day in the team's clubhouse at its spring training site in Fort Myers, Florida, to introduce Grady Little to the players as their manager. Little, who had served as Williams' bench coach for 3 seasons, was a safe, popular pick. Immediately after Lucchino introduced Little, Martinez was so happy he danced naked around the clubhouse, cracking up his teammates by shaking his member. The owners made a more important hiring that same spring training, to far less fanfare, crude or otherwise. They named a 28-year-old Yale graduate to serve as an assistant general manager to Port. Theo Epstein, who grew up 1 mile away from Fenway in Brookline, had started out in baseball as a summer intern for Lucchino's Baltimore Orioles in 1992, 1993, and 1994. Epstein followed Lucchino to San Diego, where he worked 2 seasons in the Padres' communications department, before moving to baseball operations in 1997, all the while earning a degree from the University of San Diego Law School. He was whip-smart, full of questions, and at the front of a generation of young, computer-savvy executives and analysts who believed some of the answers for evaluating players and constructing teams could be found in a careful parsing of the game's copious statistics. Change, however, did not come immediately to the Henry Werner Lucchino Red Sox. During the first half of the 2002 season, Port and his baseball operations people and scouts would hold frequent conference calls that sounded not very different from the way virtually all clubs had conducted business for generations. One of those conferences included a discussion about acquiring an outfielder. "Hey," one scout piped up, "how about that Doug Glanville? He's pretty good." "How about Marquise Grissom?" interjected another scout. "I've always liked him." The conference call went on in the same manner. Baseball men talking baseball, trusting their gut and little else. The Red Sox eventually traded for Montreal outfielder Cliff Floyd, giving the Expos pitching prospects Sun-Woo Kim and Seung Song. "That was pretty much the methodology," Epstein said. "People would sit around talking about the players they heard of and who might be a good fit. There were no numbers studied, just subjective analysis." "Old school?" "It was really old school. And not good old school. So we basically started to integrate some new techniques behind the scenes." In the back offices at Fenway, Epstein, Jed Hoyer, and other assistants in player development were running their own kind of lab, crunching numbers and asking questions in their new school way. For instance, it was the statistical analysis done by Epstein and the back office upstarts that helped lead to the Red Sox trading for left-handed relief pitcher Alan Embry in June of 2002. The Red Sox gave up 2 pitching prospects of little import to San Diego to get Embry, a journeyman making $500,000, who had bounced from the Giants to the White Sox to the Padres to the Red Sox within 12 months. But Epstein liked Embry's strikeout rate. More than 1 per inning. Embry would be an important part of Boston's bullpen over 4 seasons. "We weren't empowered to make the final call," Epstein said of the back office analysts. "But gradually, over the course of the year, we started to integrate some of these techniques. It became rather obvious what John Henry was looking for in a new GM, and because of John's thinking, I felt empowered to create a new system." Henry believed in numbers. They made him a rich man. In 1981, at the age of 31, Henry established an alternative asset money management firm that proudly took human emotion and subjective analysis out of play. It made trading decisions based on a proprietary objective system that analyzed trends in each market. By 2005, John W. Henry & Company, Incorporated held assets of $3.8 billion. By 2006, Henry was estimated to have a net worth of $860 million. Henry saw no reason why data-based analysis should not work in baseball, too. After all, he had long been a baseball fan himself, and about 20 years earlier had discovered the work of statistical analyst Bill James and other so-called sabermetricians. "We took our cues from the way his mind works," Epstein said. "He's really an empirical-based thinker. Very logical, very analytical, very objective. That led him down his career path, where he figured out trends in the market and discovered a formula. His belief is that you can look at the market objectively and the trends lie in the numbers, and even if you get battered in the short term, ultimately it's going to work out. It's empirical. Sabermetrics really appealed to him. He saw a great analogy between the financial markets and baseball. He understood the worst decisions to be the subjective ones, the older school decisions, and he wanted someone to approach baseball operations in the same systematic way he knew from the markets. He's even more devoted to a systematic approach than I am. I take a more balanced approach. Right around then, the landscape was definitely changing around baseball when it came to decision-making. The default modus operandi in the game, the old-school approach, was about to undergo a sea change. It was a time of great change, and you saw a change in the type of people making the decisions. The 2002 Red Sox won 93 games, but still missed the playoffs in what was a transitional year in the organizational culture. Henry still needed a point man to run the baseball operations in a manner that dovetailed with his objective analytical approach to the markets, and by November he knew exactly who that person was. Oakland general manager Billy Bean. But Bean turned him down for family reasons. He considered J.P. Ricciardi, who had been Bean's right-hand man in Oakland, but Ricciardi had been hired only a year earlier by the Toronto Blue Jays to be their general manager, and he wasn't about to walk away from that contract, not even to be the general manager for a team in his home state of Massachusetts. Henry then turned to his third choice, who also happened to be the one Billy Bean recommended. Epstein. On November 25th, 2002, 1 month before his 29th birthday, Epstein was named general manager of the Boston Red Sox. That same month, Henry hired James, the high priest of the sabermetric movement, and the next month he hired Josh Burns, a 32-year-old Haverford College graduate who had served under Mark Shapiro in the Cleveland Indians front office. The cultural shift in Boston was now complete. The Red Sox would run their organization with a heavy emphasis on statistical analysis to help find and exploit undervalued markets. They were the Athletics, only with a lot more money. With the new ownership and with Epstein's youthfulness, they also now had the bravado to be a true rival to the Yankees. They were now equipped to compete with the Yankees on their turf, even if that turf was in Nicaragua. On Thanksgiving, only days after being named the Red Sox general manager, Epstein telephoned his girlfriend from Logan Airport in Boston. He was supposed to be enjoying Thanksgiving dinner at her parents' home. "Sorry, but I can't make it," Epstein said. "I'm on my way to Nicaragua." One of the legendary pitchers in Cuba, Jose Contreras, had defected the previous month while in Mexico pitching for the Cuban national team. He was in Nicaragua essentially to skirt Major League draft requirements and become a free agent. The Yankees badly wanted the man Fidel Castro himself had dubbed El Titan de Bronze, the Bronze Titan, as an homage to the courage of 19th-century Cuban general Antonio Maceo. The Red Sox, however, conceded nothing to the Yankees. Indeed, Epstein's trip to Nicaragua was a symbolic beginning to Boston's mission to go eye to eye with the Yankees. "Our scouts loved him," Epstein said. "They thought he could be a number one starter in the big leagues, with some risk involved. You could not do the same statistical analysis as you could with a major league pitcher, and the issue of leaving his country and family was part of the risk. But right then, two things became clear about us. We wanted to have no fear, and we wanted to be the type of organization that could take a risk and not back away because it might make us look bad. We didn't want perception to be part of the decision-making process. For too many years, this organization was obsessed with tomorrow's newspapers and the Yankees. There was such a focus on what the Yankees were doing and looking silly in the newspapers that it almost paralyzed the club." Before Epstein left for Nicaragua, he received a call from Louis El Hawa, his director of international scouting. El Hawa had arrived there first, taking one of the 12 rooms at the hotel in the remote Nicaraguan town where Contreras and his agent, Jaime Torres, were staying. "Hey, man, it might be good if you booked a room not just for yourself, but book all the rooms in the hotel," El Hawa told Epstein. "That way other teams won't be able to stay here. The nearest place is miles and miles away." Epstein loved the idea. The Red Sox bought up all the rooms. When he arrived there, Epstein could not believe how well the plan worked. They had the place to themselves. He and Elhawa stayed up late with Contreras and Torres, drinking whiskey, smoking Cuban cigars, and talking about a new life in Boston with the Red Sox. Epstein told Contreras that the Red Sox employed a bullpen catcher who was born in Cuba and would provide him with daily support and friendship. "We probably won't be the ones with the highest offer," Epstein said, "but other teams won't give you the support and welcome that we will." Contreras loved everything that he heard about the Red Sox. They enjoyed more conversation, whiskey, and cigars before finally turning in. "I went to bed sure he would sign with the Red Sox," Epstein said. "The next day I see two shadowy figures going in and out of his room. They're from the Yankees. I see him on his cell phone." The Yankees had dispatched two operatives with a simple order. "Don't come back unless you have Contreras signed. If you don't sign him, your jobs won't be here when you get back." It wasn't long before Contreras asked to see Epstein. El Titan de Bronze had tears in his eyes. "It's nothing personal," he told Epstein. "I had a better offer. They won't take no." The Yankees gave Contreras $32 million over 4 years, blowing away Boston's offer of $23 million over 3 years. Legend has it that Epstein reacted by heaving a chair in his room and breaking furniture, a story he denies. "I did not break anything," he said. "I may have thrown a few of my possessions across the room." Lucchino, speaking to the New York Times then, reacted by throwing insults. "The evil empire extends its tentacles even into Latin America," Lucchino said. The Red Sox had lost to the Yankees. Again. Dog bites man. But Epstein saw victory in this defeat. "We were bold," Epstein said, "but we still had to be disciplined and focus on value. We did that with our offer. Our goal in player acquisition was to set a value and never get into a free agent bidding war. Don't get in without a strong sense of what our walking away point was. It's almost like a small market approach to get the most bang for every buck. At the same time, we showed we had changed. We were really following through on our goal to be really bold and not worry about looking stupid if things didn't work out." What followed in the immediate wake of the Contreras imbroglio was one of the most fertile and efficient off-seasons in the history of the Red Sox, a haul that would soon make possible the attainment of their holy grail, the World Championship more than 8 decades in the waiting. The 2002 Red Sox had finished second in the American League in runs and third in on-base percentage, but nonetheless gave far too many at-bats to inefficient hitters such as Tony Clark, Ray Sanchez, Jose Offerman, Carlos Baerga, and Shea Hillenbrand. Epstein knew his team needed hitters who were better at getting on base. In the next 3 months, Epstein added designated hitter David Ortiz, first baseman Kevin Millar, second baseman Todd Walker, third baseman Bill Miller, and outfielder Jeremy Giambi, while also adding pitchers Mike Timlin and Bronson Arroyo. The seven players cost him a total of 3 non-prospects from his minor league system, and $13 million in salary for the 2003 season. Epstein operated in the manner of an expert serial pickpocket. He was so good the rest of baseball didn't even know what hit them, especially months before Moneyball would tip off the old-school guys and what the new-school guys were up to. "The quick application of some basic principles yielded immediate results in 2003," Epstein said. "We took a look at the roster and we saw we had superstar talent on the top of the roster, but after our 10 best players, there were a lot of areas that needed improvement. We thought if we could get above-league-average players at getting on base, we'd be much better off. We needed guys to get on base. We had too many dead spots in our lineup. We also knew at that time you could get guys who got on base inexpensively. You could still find those guys, and they were still good values. You can't now. But back then, batting average correlated to salary, not on-base percentage. Now it's the opposite. All those guys had great years and had a really dramatic effect on our offense." Every hitter Epstein obtained in those heists was better than league average at getting on base. Walker, 353 OBP in 2002, and Giambi, 414, were obtained in minor trades. Miller, 350, was signed as a free agent. Ortiz, 339, was signed for $1.25 million after the Minnesota Twins cut him rather than pay him about that much in arbitration. Millar, 366, was signed after the Florida Marlins had placed him on waivers to allow him to play in Japan. The rest of baseball interpreted those waivers as the necessary formality of a player leaving the States, while the Red Sox saw the move as an opening to grab yet another player who could get on base. Other teams were angered at having been caught napping, or in their minds, simply respecting the unwritten rules in the game. It gets back to our first priority. Be bold, Epstein said. Giambi would break down with injuries, but Walker, Miller, Ortiz, and Millar were major contributors. Epstein's stealth offseason brought an immediate and huge impact. The 2003 Red Sox won the wildcard playoff spot with 95 victories, six fewer than New York, and were the greatest slugging team in baseball history, knocking the 1927 Yankees out of the record book with a .491 slugging percentage. They hit a franchise record 238 home runs and led the league with 961 runs, the second most in franchise history. A club record six teammates hit at least 20 homers. Millar, Ortiz, Manny Ramirez, Jason Veritek, Nomar Garciaparra, and Trot Nixon. Of Boston's 95 wins, 40 of them were comeback victories, including 13 in which they had trailed by 3 runs or more. The 03 team had a bunch of guys that just didn't know any better, Epstein said. It didn't matter how badly we pitched. We knew we could kick your ass and beat the ball around the park. Within 2 years, the savvy ownership of the Red Sox had assembled a true rival to the Yankees, with team-building tools and know-how that were ahead of the curve. In 2003, the Red Sox, little more than a cooperative sparring partner for the Yankees during New York's championship years, were good enough and cocky enough to push the Yankees to the brink of a tipping point. One game to decide the American League championship, if not the arrival of a new paradigm coming to baseball. One game. It was, quite simply, one of the greatest baseball games ever played. 7. The Ghosts Make a Final Appearance. David Wells had been a colorful nuisance during his first stint with the Yankees, and the same was true when he rejoined the team in 2002. He might sometimes throw his arms up in burlesque disgust if a teammate made an error behind him. He might quarrel with Torrey and pitching coach Mel Stottlemyre. He might let himself get too heavy, and he might stay out at night a little too late. But the incidents, even one involving a police report in 2002, mostly could be written off as the incidental cost of his immaturity, like bothersome toll booths on the highway to his usual 17 wins or so. The 2002 incident, for instance, occurred at an East Side diner, where a heckling fan punched Wells, knocking out his 2 front teeth and bloodying him. Wells had pitched one of his classically efficient games that Friday night, September 6th, beating Detroit 8-1 in a complete game with no walks that took just 2 hours and 28 minutes, all the quicker so Wells could get to the business of trolling the Manhattan bar scene. Wells threw back shots of tequila at a Soho club before heading to the diner for something to eat, not expecting it to be the flying fist of a 5'7" diner patron. Torrey called Wells into his office the next day. "What time did this happen?" he asked Wells. "It was about 12:45 or something," Wells said. It was a bold-faced lie. Wells apparently forgot that 911 emergency calls, of which he had placed one that night, are dated and placed in public record.
"I just got my teeth knocked in, all right?"
he barked at the 911 operator during a 2-minute screed in which he slurred his words and repeatedly cursed at the operator.
"Nine motherfucking 1-1, he spat out through his bloodied mouth.
It was soon apparent beyond any doubt that Wells had lied to Torrey about when the incident occurred. He was off only by about 5 hours. Wells had placed his 911 call at 5:49 a.m. "I had no report at the time to the contrary," Torrey said. "I always want to believe my players, but he just out and out lied." Lying tore at the trust between Tori and his players, which was the very foundation of his entire managerial philosophy. Wells' lie immensely bothered Tori because of that willful destruction. It encroached upon the absolute worst kind of betrayal in Tori's book between a manager and his players, insubordination. In 1981, for instance, Tori was managing the Mets when he and Bob Gibson, his pitching coach, saw two players, Ron Hodges and Dyer Miller, in the bar of a team's hotel, which was off-limits to the players. "Go over there and tell them to finish their beer and leave," Tori told Gibson. "I'm not looking to catch people, but just tell them to finish up and go out." The players told Gibson they would take their time with their beer, thank you. They did not leave. The next day, Tori called Hodges and Miller into his office. They were joined by Rusty Staub, the respected clubhouse leader, whom Tori invited to have on hand as a witness, as a form of documentation. "Guys," Tori told Hodges and Miller, "I'm sending you home. I told the clubhouse guy to get your luggage off the truck. You're not going with us to Philadelphia. You're going home." As Tori explained, "I hated doing it, but I had to. It was insubordination." Miller looked in astonishment at Tori, and, referring to Mets general manager Frank Cashin, said, "Does Frank know about this?" "Not until I tell him," Tori said. Tori told Cashin about it while the two players were on their way back to New York. Cashin asked Tori the next day, "Do you realize this thing was over one beer?" "Yep," Tori said. "If you lift the suspension," Cashin said, "I can have them in Philly in time for the game tonight." "If I lift the suspension," Tori said, "you might as well take the rules and stick them up your ass." What Wells did, lying to him face to face, was a betrayal of Tori and the Yankees that, as the manager saw it, walked right up to the line of insubordination. That was probably the one incident that came closest to insubordination, Tori said. "But that became an issue for the front office, not under my discipline, because it was a legal matter." Wells survived the incident, as he always did with the Yankees, with almost no collateral damage. Not only did he make his next start as scheduled, he also won all his starts the rest of the season, going 3-0 with a 1.64 ERA to finish with a team-leading 19 wins. Wells continually pushed the boundaries of what it meant to be a Yankee. He was a counterculture iconoclastic party boy in the buttoned-down pinstriped world, the rebel without a pause, but somehow always managed to survive on the strength of his golden left arm. No matter how much Wells drank or cursed or ranted or lied, he was blessed with a rubber arm and a kind of stealth athleticism that could allow him to repeat his finely balanced delivery, the key to throwing a baseball precisely where he wanted over and over again, as routinely and as exactly as dotting I's and crossing T's in the most elegant handwriting imaginable. Wells could wake up Christmas morning in a snowstorm after an all-night bender and paint the outside corner with his fastball, maybe even blindfolded. His mechanics and his arm were that good. "When you're on a team that's mature," Tori said, "a guy like David Wells can be a real benefit because he can pitch. And everybody understands that. Understands that this guy can help us, so let's do everything we can to help him. And if it's kissing his ass or whatever it is, let's do it. It depends on the group. It's something you don't know until you get them together and what their makeup is." According to Messina, "Boomer was high maintenance. Boomer was even loud and high maintenance. And I like Boomer. He's funny. I never took him too seriously. I had no problem playing with him, whatever else happened. I didn't have any problem playing with Boomer." At spring training in 2003, however, Wells finally pushed the envelope of his rebellion too far, at least with the front office. He pushed it far enough that not even his golden arm could save him from the wrath of George Steinbrenner. His crime? Wells wrote a book, Perfect I'm Not, Boomer on Beer, Brawls, Backaches, and Baseball. It was an immediate problem for the Yankees when the galley proofs circulated that February. Wells claimed he was half-drunk when he threw his perfect game in 1998, estimated that up to 40% in the big leagues used steroids, a number he reduced to 25 upon the book's release. took some veiled shots at teammates Roger Clemens and Messina, and said you could stand anywhere in the Yankees clubhouse and be within 10 feet of a supply of amphetamines. Wells could show up teammates on the field, stay out all night long, and lie to the manager, but writing a book that impugned the integrity of the Yankee franchise finally put him on ground where Steinbrenner said, "Enough." It became an important episode for Torrey, far more significant than the 2002 lying incident, because the shrapnel that flew from the book fallout would forever damage Torrey's standing with the front office. Steinbrenner was outraged about the book, and deliberated for a few days about what he should do with Wells. "He's given Daryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden second chances," Wells told reporters, referring to two former drug users whom Steinbrenner personally signed with the Yankees. "I deserve a second chance." Steinbrenner summoned Torrey to a meeting at Legends Field in Tampa. Torrey rode the elevator from the lobby, on the ground floor where the clubhouse was located, to the fourth floor and the executive offices. Torrey walked into the conference room and found Steinbrenner with General Manager Brian Cashman, Assistant General Manager Jean Afterman, Chief Operating Officer Lon Trost, and Public Relations Director Rick Cerrone. Also in the meeting by way of speakerphone from New York was President Randy Levine. Steinbrenner looked at Torrey and said, "What do you think we should do about David Wells?" "What I would do if I were you," Torrey told Steinbrenner, "is call him up here and tell him to shut the fuck up." "No," Steinbrenner said. "I want you to tell him..." Torrey cut him off. "I'm not telling him anything," Torrey said. "This has nothing to do with me. If you have something to say to him, you say it to him. Simple. It will be over with. Call him up here. Tell him." Torrey knew Steinbrenner had a weakness. As often and as easily as Steinbrenner could berate people, he never liked to do so on a one-on-one basis. Said Torrey, "He always wanted to do it with two other people there. He wanted to scare you in front of other people." Steinbrenner wanted no part of dealing with Wells himself. "Here's what I want you to do," Steinbrenner told Torrey. "I want you to make him the 11th pitcher on the staff." Steinbrenner wanted to punish Wells by taking him out of the starting rotation and banishing him to mop-up duty in the bullpen. The Yankees had been 23-8 when Wells started for them the previous season. "I can't do that," Torrey told Steinbrenner. "I don't like the son of a bitch all that much, but I can't do that. He can still win, and he's still going to help you win ball games." Steinbrenner and Torrey began arguing back and forth. Steinbrenner insisting Torrey bury Wells, Torrey explaining he would be punishing Wells' teammates if he did that. Steinbrenner telling Torrey it was his job to discipline his players, Torrey telling Steinbrenner that this was an off-the-field issue that was his responsibility. And on it went. Until Torrey had enough. And Torrey had enough not just of this argument about David Wells. He also had enough of Steinbrenner. "You know what?" Torrey told Steinbrenner. "I'm sick and tired of this shit. You keep pounding at me, pounding at me, pounding at me. It bothers me. I probably shouldn't tell you that, but it bothers me." Suddenly, the voice of Levine was broadcast over the room via the speakerphone on Steinbrenner's conference room table. Levine started to say something, but Torrey immediately cut him off. "Randy," Torrey said, "shut the fuck up." The room went silent for just a moment, a small moment, but one packed with awkwardness. Said Torrey, "I found out Randy had been trying to find a way to get rid of me from that moment on." "Understood." Levine wasn't there for the bulk of the championship Yankees seasons. He hopped aboard the championship train only in time for its last stop, joining the club in January of 2000. He had no connection to the rise of the dynasty and the groundwork of trust Torrey formed with his players, and he had no connection to baseball operations. Levine was there because he was a smart, savvy political operative who knew how to steer the Yankees through the labyrinth of rules, regulations, and red tape as they planned the equivalent of the two most mammoth offshore drilling projects to find revenues to keep them at the economic forefront of the next century. The launch of their own regional sports network, and the construction of a new Yankee stadium. Levine knew how to get things done in New York City. Before joining the Yankees, he served as the city's deputy mayor for economic development, planning, and administration. He was a graduate of George Washington University and Hofstra School of Law. Levine quickly became an important force with the Yankees, providing a daily presence in New York, while Steinbrenner spent more and more time in Tampa. Reporters learned to tap him for leaks, someone who anonymously would push the Yankee agenda, as Steinbrenner slowly retreated from feeding the tabloids. The art of the leak, a skill Levine sharpened in politics as one of Mayor Rudy Giuliani's most trusted advisors. Levine's political bearings clashed with Tory's emphasis on organizational and personal trust. Tory believed an organization operated at peak efficiency only when all relationships were built on trust, and that the shared vision of winning overrode, even muted, individual agendas. He believed in people, but too often Tory cringed at the quickness and coldness with which the Yankees on Levine's watch could turn against one of their own. The Yankees' reaction to a player in crisis often included exploring the possibility of getting out from under the responsibility of having to pay the player. They sometimes sought to excise wounds, not heal them. Among those about whom they were quick to investigate contractual relief starting in 2000 were Bubba Trammell, an outfielder suffering from depression who, unannounced, simply did not show up for work one day. Chuck Knoblauch, who wanted to quit because of a mental block about throwing the ball from second base. Jason Giambi, because of his reported Balco grand jury testimony in which he admitted steroid use. Carl Pavano, who seemed to look for reasons not to pitch and didn't tell the Yankees about two cracked ribs suffered in an auto accident. Kevin Brown, who broke his hand in a fit of anger, and Johnny Damon, because of his retirement thoughts caused by a kind of battle fatigue. The most infamous and longest-lasting case of the Yankees turning against one of their own involved Giambi. On the day after Giambi's grand jury testimony was reported by the San Francisco Chronicle in 2004, the newspapers were awash in leaks from the Yankees that they already were investigating the possibility of voiding his contract. The same scenario occurred in 2007 when Giambi implicated himself in steroid use by telling a reporter he was part of a playing culture that was wrong for doing that stuff. Of course, the legal ground upon which the Yankees were standing seemed as unstable as a sinkhole, considering they specifically removed the word steroid from his contract when they signed him, changing the language to more generic references, such as controlled substance, in the belief, they said, that broader language offered them better liability protection. Indeed, the desire to get out from under Giambi and his contract would bubble between 2004 and 2007 just about every time Giambi wasn't hitting or was hurt. During one such time, Tory said Levine tried to see if the Yankees could cut Giambi without pay on the grounds of insubordination for refusing an assignment to the minor leagues. Cash told him we can't do that, Tory said. During another front office campaign against Giambi, the team physician, Dr. Stuart Hershon, would walk into Torrey's office on a daily basis to say why Giambi was available to play. He would come down with word from George and Randy to find out why Jason wasn't playing, Tory said. He looked very uneasy. He's able to play, the doctor told Tory one day. He can play. I know, Tory said. I'm choosing not to play him. Said Tory, it appeared that they wanted the fact that he was refusing to play to come out of that. They never asked me to say Jason, in fact, refused to play. They never included me in any discussions. I just didn't think he was one of our best options at the time. For a third straight day, Hershon poked his head into Tory's office to again find out what was going on with Giambi. It would be the last such day. You know, Doc, Tory said, get the fuck out of my office. I don't want to hear it anymore. If George has a problem with it, fine. But don't tell me who to play. Stay out of my office. Tory always did hate confrontations, probably because he grew up in an abusive household under the iron fist of his father, Joe Sr. But he loathed nearly as much as confrontations the damage people could do by scheming covertly. The thing I can't stand, and I guess it goes on in a lot of businesses, is when stuff goes on behind people's backs, Tory said. If something needs to be addressed, I address it. As much as I hate confrontation, I have to do it. Avoiding it is torture. I remember when I was managing St. Louis and I had a meeting with Kenny Hill, a pitcher, and said, you seem to get to a point in a game where you seem to lose your focus. And then he said, "Well, Tom Pagnozzi, he does this and he does that." Pagnozzi was the catcher. I said, "Whoa, time out. Tommy, come over here." Kenny Hill was mortified because here I am calling over the catcher he was talking about. I said, "Let's get this thing solved. We're not going to hurt each other's feelings. Let's find a way to make this better by working together." But that's what I do. I bring players in. The 2003 spring training meeting with Wells at Legends Field, with Levine, Steinbrenner, Cashman, Torrey, and others, ended without a resolution. Indeed, it took Steinbrenner and the Yankees 2 weeks to come to a resolution about what to do. Wells clearly was bothered by the criticism fired at him from inside and outside the organization over the book. On February 28th, before a spring training game in Clearwater against the Phillies, Wells told Torrey and Cashman that he wanted to quit. "David," Torrey told Wells, "your name is on the book."
"I didn't know that stuff was in there," he said.
"David, did you go over the pages in the book? Did you do any of that?"
"No."
"Well, I don't know what to tell you. I'm going to quit." Torrey knew Wells was speaking out of frustration. Torrey had been here before, listening to a hardened, admired big league player with world-class skills and millions of dollars tell him he wanted to quit. Wells followed Knobloch and would precede others among those Yankees who reached a breaking point and wanted to walk away from baseball. All of them were reminders of the frailty of the human spirit. Even among the physically strong and the sports celebrities considered to have it all, and to be living the charmed life. Wells was highly emotional when he met with Torrey and Cashman. "Don't quit," Torrey told Wells. "Just don't quit. Go home now and come back tomorrow. Just think about it. Nobody wants you to quit. You just have to talk to these players and do what you have to do to apologize to them to make this whole. But don't just quit. You've got too much to offer." Wells stuck around. The Yankees, after negotiations with Wells' agent, settled on fining Wells $100,000. A short time later, Sports Illustrated arranged a photo shoot at Legends Field for what would be the cover of the magazine's baseball preview issue. The idea would be to pose Steinbrenner surrounded by the Yankees' 6 starting pitchers to whom he was paying a combined $46.5 million. Roger Clemens, Andy Pettit, Mike Messina, David Wells, Jeff Weaver, and Jose Contreras. Wells refused to be included, still smarting from the book contretemps, but also because he had accused SI in the past of doctoring an action shot of him to make him appear fatter. A wildly inaccurate accusation, of course. "You can't have too much pitching. In parentheses, just ask George," read the cover. So there it was. Me, Andy, Roger, Weaver, Contreras, and George. And not even Boomer in the picture, Messina said. "Now, I don't know what else you want for a staff, but that's about as good as it goes. That's as good a group of people as I probably ever had a chance to play with." So stacked were the Yankees with starting pitchers that their number 6 starter, Weaver and Contreras shuttled between the 5th spot and long relief, could have been the number 1 starter on many other teams. They were as good as advertised. Clemens, Pettit, Wells, and Messina all pitched more than 200 innings, marking only the 12th time in franchise history the Yankees had 4 such workhorses, but the first time ever in the era of the 5-man rotation. All 4 won at least 15 games with only single-digit losses, making the 2003 Yankees rotation one of only 12 in baseball history to be so successful. The only other Yankees rotations in that group occurred way back in 1927 and 1932. The staff issued the fewest walks per game of any Yankees team since 1906. Torrey always believed the blueprint for a championship team began with the rotation, and the 2003 Yankees represented one of Torrey's strongest staffs. His starters threw 1,066 innings that year, the most in his 12 years with the Yankees, and won 83 games, exceeded only by the historic 1998 team. The 2003 Yankees rolled to 101 victories and had the pitching to extend the dynasty to what would have been a 5th world championship in 8 years. Alas, they fell 2 wins short of the title, losing to the 91-win Florida Marlins team that ran into a hot spell at the right time. That the Yankees even made it to the 2003 World Series was in itself a memorable achievement. It took every game and every inning of the American League Championship Series and then some at that. It took a kind of noise and a kind of intense emotion the likes of which never quite before or after ever shook the grand old stadium. It took one of the greatest baseball games ever played. It took what would be the last miracle in the Bronx. On October 16, 2003, a Thursday, United States Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld composed an internal memo to his top advisors under the subject heading Global War on Terrorism, in which he wrote, "It is pretty clear that the coalition can win in Afghanistan and Iraq in one way or another, but it will be a long, hard slog." That same Thursday, President Bush met privately in a hotel suite with California Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger. Had the same men convened only 13 years earlier, you would have been talking about a meeting with slightly less gravitas, considering it would have been the man running the Texas Rangers baseball team, chatting up the star of Kindergarten Cop. The world on October 16, 2003 could seem as confusing and changeable as ever, and perhaps nowhere else more so than at an empty Fenway Park in Boston. For on that morning, grounds crew workers carefully painted the 2003 World Series logo on the grass behind home plate. The World Series was scheduled to begin two nights hence in the home park of the American League champion. As the workers at Fenway rolled and brushed the paint on Fenway's lush turf, there was one small detail yet to be worked out before the festivities. The Red Sox still had to play Game 7 of the American League Championship Series at Yankee Stadium that night against the Yankees. The Red Sox no longer looked the role of the cartoon coyote against the Yankees. They had grown into a rival of the most authentic, worthy, and anxiety-inducing sort. And Torrey knew it. Hours before Game 7, Torrey sat in his office at Yankee Stadium and wondered if the Yankees could beat Boston one more time, as agonizing and draining as he knew even the victories had been against the Red Sox.
"Well, they were better than us in 03," Torrey said. "Let's put it this way. They scared me more than they ever did before. Of course, they always scared me. You can't help it when it's the Red Sox. But eventually you say to yourself, when is this shit going to end? How long do we keep beating them before the law of averages catches up to us?"
Growing up in New York, I knew about the wars between the Dodgers and Giants 22 times a year. But not being personally involved in it, other than as a fan, I had never experienced anything like the whole Red Sox-Yankees thing. It was personal. I mean, Don Mattingly said he didn't want his son to be drafted by the Red Sox. That's how deep-seated it is. It becomes personal among the players.
Mel Stottlemyre, Torrey's trusted pitching coach, stepped into Torrey's office before Game 7.
"You've got Moose in the bullpen tonight," Stottlemyre said. Said Torrey, "I've got everybody in the bullpen tonight."
Mike Messina, Moose, had started and lost Game 4 3 days earlier. Messina had pitched well, taking the ball two outs into the seventh inning, but Boston starter Tim Wakefield had pitched better. Messina left with a 3-1 deficit in a game the Red Sox would win 3-2, a game in which Boston manager Grady Little pulled Tim Wakefield after 7 innings and 100 pitches, so relievers Mike Timlin and Scott Williamson could get the final 6 outs. Messina had appeared in 431 games in his professional career entering Game 7, postseasons included. Not one of those 431 appearances came out of the bullpen. "We might use you out of the pen," Stottlemyre had told Messina. "But if we do, we won't bring you into the middle of an inning. We'll only have you start an inning. That way you'll have plenty of time to warm up." One of the beauties of baseball is its forgiveness. There is always another at-bat, another game, another chance to right a wrong. And those redemptive opportunities, unlike in other sports, are made possible on a daily basis. A team plays 162 games in 181 days. A batter will get 600 chances. A pitcher will face 900 batters. A season will offer 750,000 pitches. The sheer volume of opportunity is what gives the game its rhythm and soul. Until you get a Game 7. Game 7 flips baseball inside out, replacing near-endless opportunity with urgency.
Injected with a heavy dose of finality, baseball in a Game 7 scenario is thrillingly different. There have been only 47 decisive Game 7s played in the history of baseball. None were ever more anticipated, none were more fraught with tension and ill will than Game 7 of the 2003 American League Championship Series. The starting pitchers alone guaranteed something historic, if not downright dangerous. The Yankees started Roger Clemens. The Red Sox gave the ball to Pedro Martinez. Between them, Clemens and Martinez had won 476 games in the major leagues, a record total for any Game 7 pitching matchup. They had combined to win 9 Cy Young Awards. They were not only among the best pitchers of their generation, they also were among the most feared. Both Clemens and Martinez used the baseball not just to beat you, but to intimidate you. They threw at and near batters regularly with a frontier justice mentality, the kind of machismo that mostly had disappeared from the game. Clemens liked to use a euphemism for such intimidation tactics. He called it moving a batter's feet, and he would say so with the matter-of-fact casualness associated with moving someone's furniture. Martinez, meanwhile, quickly had developed such a reputation for throwing at batters that one of them once charged the mound, certain that Pedro had hit him on purpose, a pitch thrown with a perfect game intact. Moreover, Martinez and Clemens never cared much for each other. Already Game 3 at Fenway Park in Boston had proved the explosive properties at play when you mix the Yankees and Red Sox and Clemens and Martinez. The two aces started that game, and considerable mayhem. The Yankees did not like Martinez, so much so that when Martinez later became a free agent following the 2004 season, several of them would go out of their way to tell Torrey the Yankees should stay clear of him. When he was a free agent, there was some idle chatter about him coming to the Yankees, but there was genuine dislike from our players, Torrey said. They didn't want him around, and they told me so. We didn't like him. We didn't like him for a reason. I mean, he would get away with throwing at people. There was one game in New York where he hit Soriano and Jeter back-to-back and put them both in the hospital. This is a guy who can put the ball where he wants, and he certainly has the right mentality, that if you're going to pitch somebody in, you miss in and hit them. I don't see anything wrong with it. It's better than missing over the plate and the guy hits a home run. That's what you try to teach, and not a lot of guys can do that. We used to hate Clemens for the same reason when he was on another team. Beside his penchant for pitching inside, Martinez irritated the Yankees with his bench jockeying, another old-school tactic that seemed out of place in the modern game. He would insult the Yankees from the Boston dugout. Catcher Jorge Posada was a favorite target. Martinez would question Posada's intelligence and call him Dumbo, a reference to the catcher's prominent ears. It was a shrewd tactic, for Martinez knew that Posada was an emotional player, and the more Martinez riled Posada, the more Posada became distracted. Posada was a career 191 hitter against his tormentor, entering the 2003 ALCS. In Game 3, however, the Yankees would not let Martinez have his way with them. Boston staked Pedro to a 2-0 first-inning lead off Clemens, but the Yankees, led by the fiery Posada, fought back with aggressive hitting against Martinez. Posada opened the second inning with a double and later scored on a single by journeyman outfielder Kareem Garcia. Derek Jeter hit a home run in the third inning to tie the score, and by the fourth inning the Yankees were so emboldened by their hacks against Pedro that they turned the tables and were razzing him from their dugout. "You've got nothing," they yelled at Martinez. It was Posada who started another rally in the fourth, this time with a walk. Nick Johnson followed with a single off the Green Monster in left field, a shot that sent Posada to third. Hideki Matsui drove the next pitch into right field for a ringing double that bounced into the stands, scoring Posada. Now the Yankees, led by Posada, were all over Martinez with catcalls from the dugout. Martinez was facing Garcia, a left-handed batter, with first base open and a right-handed hitter on deck. His first pitch to Garcia was a fastball that whistled straight for Garcia's head. Garcia ducked, and the ball glanced off his left shoulder. The Yankees were outraged. The way they saw it, Martinez threw at Garcia intentionally, having grown frustrated with their aggressive swings and mouthing off from the dugout. "Was Pedro trying to make a point? I'm sure he was," later said one of Martinez's teammates, pitcher John Burkett. Roger does it, Randy Johnson does it at times, and Pedro does it. I don't think he was trying to hurt him. He was trying to send a message. It was, fuck this, I've got to put a scare into somebody. And he did. Martinez claimed the pitch carried no intentions. It simply got away from him. Why am I going to hit Kareem Garcia? He said. Who is Kareem Garcia? Kareem Garcia is an out. He's not the one I want to let go. The catcalls continued from the Yankee dugout. The next batter, Alfonso Soriano, hit a ground ball to shortstop that the Red Sox turned into a double play, but not before the enraged Garcia slid hard into second baseman Todd Walker in an attempt to disrupt the pivot and to vent his anger at being hit. Garcia picked himself up off the dirt and glared angrily at Martinez as he jogged across the infield toward the third base dugout. Martinez rightfully interpreted Garcia's stare as a message that Garcia believed Martinez had purposefully tried to hit him. Why am I going to try to hit you? Martinez yelled at Garcia. You're my out. Motherfucker, Garcia yelled back. You're the motherfucker, you dirty bastard, Martinez shouted. When I said that, Martinez said, Posada jumped up on the dugout steps and started screaming at me in Spanish. I could hear him yell at me, and then he made a comment about my mother. Posada is Latin. He should know if you don't want to fuck with someone, you don't say anything about their mother. One thing in the Dominican culture you have to be very careful about is saying anything about someone's mother. You say something about someone's mother, you're picking a fight right away. If I even see someone raising his voice to his mother, you're going to get slapped in the mouth. Posada is from Puerto Rico. Being Latin, he should know that. Martinez no longer cared about Garcia. He turned his attention to Posada in the dugout. Martinez raised his right index finger and pointed it to the right side of his head and yelled something in Spanish at him. Martinez said he yelled, I'll remember what you said. Posada and the Yankees heard and interpreted something very different. They saw Martinez's actions as a clear threat that he was going to hit Posada in the head with a pitch the next time he batted. Clemens, of course, would not let such actions go unanswered. The question was not if he would respond with a militant pitch, just a little something to move somebody's feet, but when. A jam in the sixth inning of a close game, with one out, a 4-2 lead, and the tying runs on base did not appear to be the proper opening for retribution, but Manny Ramirez figured differently. The Yankees always discussed in their pregame scouting report meetings that Ramirez was uncomfortable with inside pitches. The reports said you could get Manny off his game by occasionally throwing balls on his hands, off the plate. Such warning shots could make Ramirez less bold about diving into outside pitches. The reports also included notations that such pitches typically had no effect whatsoever on David Ortiz, Boston's other big slugger and confirmed Yankee killer. Ortiz would respond to any such pitches simply by spitting into his palms and resuming his customary aggressive place, practically on top of home plate. Unlike Ramirez, the Yankees regarded Ortiz as unable to be intimidated. Clemens uncorked a high fastball that, while somewhat inside, did not come all that close to hitting Ramirez. Still, Ramirez, sensing as all of the Red Sox did that Clemens would not let the fourth inning incident with Martinez go unchallenged, thought Clemens threw at him. Ramirez ducked and then, bat in hand, stormed toward the mound. The players and coaches from both dugouts immediately dashed toward the middle of the field, except for one 72-year-old Yankees coach who made a straight line toward the Boston dugout. Don Zimmer had seen and heard enough of Martinez. This incident, Zimmer figured, was caused by Martinez and his years of throwing at hitters and mouthing off at the Yankees. He saw Pedro in his red warm-up jacket across the field, and that's where he headed. Zimmer didn't know what he was going to do when he got there. He just knew he was fed up with Martinez. The only thing I remember, Torrey said, is when I was going out of the dugout, Zimmer was on my left and maybe a step or two below me. I was going to say, Zim, you stay here, but I knew it was fruitless. I mean, me stopping him or anybody stopping him, it wasn't going to happen. It's the last I remember, Zim. And then I was in the middle of the scrum with everybody else in the middle of the field, and I heard Zim or somebody yell something near their dugout, and I look over. He's already on the ground. Zimmer had charged Martinez in the manner of a bull in a ring, and a stunned Martinez had responded in the manner of a matador. He sidestepped Zimmer and pushed Zimmer to the ground. He reached for my right arm, Martinez said. I thought, is he going to pull it? Is he trying to hurt me? I tossed him down. The sight of this 72-year-old man tumbling to the ground, his bald pink head capless against the dark green grass in front of the Boston dugout, was so jarring as to effectively end what otherwise might have been a full-scale brawl. Clemens said at first he thought the prone round body might have been that of teammate David Wells. Zimmer was unhurt, though the Yankees would insist he be strapped to a gurney and hauled away in an ambulance to a hospital. Zimmer was, however, deeply embarrassed. He called a news conference the next day and, through tears, apologized for his actions. His contrition did not stop New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg from suggesting that Martinez would be arrested if he acted that way in New York. "Whatever kind of baseball they want to play, we're going to play. But we didn't start that," Clemens said after the game, barely containing his anger toward Martinez. "Sometimes when you get knocked around the ballpark, you get your ticket punched. I've had it many times. These guys have done it to me. If you don't have electric stuff and you're not on and guys are hitting balls they shouldn't be hitting, you might stand somebody up. But just because you are getting whipped, you don't hit somebody behind somebody's neck. I wasn't a part of all that. I went in there and I was trying to strike Manny out, and bottom line is he started mouthing me and the ball wasn't near him. If I wanted it near him, he'd know it." Torrey pulled Clemens after he pitched out of that sixth inning by getting Ramirez to ground into a double play. Clemens might have lasted longer, but Torrey figured Clemens had spent himself physically and emotionally in such fitful battle. He had noticed the veins bulging on Clemens' neck. The Yankees couldn't get through the game without one more fight, this one a bloody one in the New York bullpen between a Fenway Park security guard, pitcher Jeff Nelson, and right fielder Garcia, who hopped the fence. The rivalry had become sheer madness, so when Torrey needed order restored, he turned to the reliable coolness of Mariano Rivera. The closer took care of the final 6 outs of a 4-3 victory with no runs, no hits, and no incidents, requiring just 19 pitches to do so. The outrageousness of Game 3 established the animosity and competitiveness of the series that would build toward the 7th game. Starting with Game 3, the teams alternated wins over 4 games, in which each one hung in the balance into the 9th inning. So it would come down to this. The Yankees and Red Sox playing each other for the 26th time that year, the most 2 teams had seen of one another in baseball history, and a Yankee Stadium reprise of the Martinez-Clemens pitching matchup. To add to the drama, the game stood as a chance to be the last time Clemens pitched in the big leagues. He had announced his intention to retire after the season, an intention that actually took 4 years to consummate. But the expectation at the time was that this might be his last game. Martinez did not sleep well before Game 7. For one reason, his body clock was askew from a weary travel schedule. In the previous 19 days, he had flown from Boston to Tampa to Oakland to Boston to Oakland to New York to Boston to New York. For another reason, Martinez was anxious, even fearful, of the hostility he might find in New York after the incidents from Game 3. He read and heard comments that he should be thrown in jail for what he did to Zimmer, and that fans were going to come to Game 7 armed with rocks and batteries to throw at him in the bullpen. His brother, the former pitcher Ramon Martinez, wanted to watch his kid brother pitch with the pennant on the line at Yankee Stadium, but Pedro would not allow it. "Stay in Boston," he told Ramon. "Anything can happen." Martinez made certain not to leave his hotel room while in New York. On the day of Game 7, he ordered some Dominican food delivered to his room rather than venturing out for lunch. He took the team bus to the ballpark rather than trust a New York cabbie to bring him safely to the ballpark. The Yankees never liked Martinez much, but now he felt the wrath of the citizens of the city for having flung an old, huggable man to the ground. Burkett, knowing this was likely to be his final season, had toted a video camera throughout the playoffs. It was rolling in the clubhouse before Game 7. One of his favorite images, taken unobtrusively, is of Martinez sitting alone, facing into his locker, his face taut with concentration and anxiousness. Martinez embraced the challenge, clearly outpitching an ineffective Clemens in the early innings. Boston whacked Clemens for 3 runs in the 3rd inning, while Martinez was giving the Yankees nothing. Kevin Millar ripped Clemens' first pitch of the 4th inning for a home run, and it was 4-0. The Red Sox didn't stop there. Trot Nixon walked, and then Bill Miller lashed a single to center field. The Yankees were on the cusp of getting blown out, already down 4 runs to a sharp Martinez, with Boston runners at 1st and 3rd and no outs. Torrey had little choice but to pull Clemens from the wreckage before it grew even worse. Clemens walked off the field in that slow, ambling cowboy walk of his, but the Yankee Stadium crowd was in too foul of a mood to send him off to his retirement with polite applause. When the bullpen door swung open, an accidental reliever walked out. It was Messina. There he was, making the first relief appearance of his professional life and having to do so by parachuting into the middle of an inning, exactly the scenario Stottlemyre had told him would not happen. Trouble was, Stottlemyre did not tell Torrey he promised Messina he would relieve only at the start of the inning. All Torrey knew was that the game was on the line right now and it was time to break glass in case of emergency. Messina was his best option. Messina first had to face Boston catcher Jason Veritek. He struck him out on 3 pitches. Next up was center fielder Johnny Damon. Messina induced a ground ball to Jeter, who turned it into an inning-ending double play. Just like that, with 6 pitches to 2 batters, Messina had authored his signature moment as a Yankee. Until then, he had acquired the reputation of a nearly great pitcher. Reliable, yes, but always somehow short of real greatness. He had never won 20 games in a season, had come within 1 strike of throwing a perfect game against Boston in 2001, and had lost 4 straight postseason decisions for the Yankees, including 2 in the 2003 ALCS alone. Messina's relief work grew in stature as the game unfolded. The Yankees finally broke through against Martinez when Jason Giambi whacked his first pitch of the 5th inning for a home run. Meanwhile, Messina tacked on 2 more shutout innings. He had thrown 33 pitches and kept the Yankees within range of Pedro when Torrey decided to take him out after the 6th inning, turning to left-handed reliever Felix Heredia to face Damon and Todd Walker, 2 left-handed hitters due up for Boston. Told he was done for the night, Messina turned to Torrey in the dugout and said, "I thought you weren't going to bring me in the middle of an inning." Said Torrey, kiddingly, because he was unaware of what Stottlemyre had told him, "Well, I guess we lied to you." Then Torrey turned serious. He drew closer to his pitcher and told him, "All I can tell you is you pitched the game of your life here. If anybody ever questions how you handle pressure, you answered that right here. Don't you ever forget that." "Thanks," Messina said. "Oh, and one more thing," Torrey said. "Maybe when we come back next spring, we'll take a look at you out of the bullpen." "No, no. No thanks," Messina said. Torrey, of course, was kidding, but Messina's clutch relief work had allowed some levity and hope in a game the Yankees still trailed by 3 against a determined, if somewhat weary, Martinez. The lack of sleep, the anxiety about the cauldron of New York, the 3 weeks of crossing time zones, all of it sapped a bit of energy from Martinez. Even though he cruised through the 6th inning, Martinez came off the field, sat next to assistant trainer Chris Correnti, and offered something revealing. "Chris," he said, "I'm a little fatigued." In the 7th, Martinez locked down the first 2 outs without apparent difficulty. But then Giambi hammered his 2nd home run of the game to cut the lead to 4-2. Now Martinez only needed to dispatch Enrique Wilson to end the inning. Wilson normally would be the last guy you would want taking an at-bat when you were down to the last 7 outs of your playoff life. Quite simply, Enrique Wilson was one of the worst hitters ever to play for the New York Yankees. He appeared in 264 games for the Yankees and batted .216. Only 4 men in the history of the franchise ever hit worse with that much time in pinstripes. Bill Robinson, .206, 1967 through 69. Jim Mason, 208, 1974 through 76, Lute Boone, 210, 1913 through 16, and Steve Balboni, 214, 1981 through 90. Moreover, Wilson was neither especially fleet nor adept in the field. His value essentially came down to one specific and unexplainable skill. He could hit Pedro Martinez. Wilson was a career 500 hitter against Martinez, with 10 hits and 20 at-bats, including a freakish 7-for-8 performance that year alone. Torrey started Wilson at third base on those numbers alone, though his regular starting third baseman had given him no reason why he should stay in the lineup. Aaron Boone, looking overmatched, was hitting 125 in the ALCS, with 2 hits and 16 at-bats. Naturally, Martinez could not get Wilson out. Wilson reached base with an infield single. Garcia, whom Martinez had treated as his plastic duck decoy for Game 3 target practice, smacked the next pitch for a single. Martinez had so cruised through most of the game that he had thrown only 11 pitches out of the stretch position before Garcia's hit. But now that the Yankees had the tying runs on base and Soriano at bat, Martinez had to tap whatever reserve tank of energy he possessed. Soriano fought Martinez through a grueling 6-pitch at bat. On the last pitch, Soriano swung and missed for strike 3. It was Pedro's 100th pitch of the game. As Martinez walked off the mound, he gave thanks to God by pointing to the sky. Red Sox Nation recognized the body language. It was Pedro's usual coda to a full night's work, his signature sign-off. It was the look of a man who was done, who had delivered his team with 100 pitches to a 4-2 lead and within 6 outs of the World Series. Martinez's teammates recognized the look. As Martinez walked into the third base end of the Boston dugout, shortstop Nomar Garcia Parra threw his arms around Martinez in a hug, a gesture of appreciation for the game he pitched. At the other end of the dugout, nearest to home plate, Boston pitching coach Dave Wallace pulled his pitching log notebook and a pencil from his pocket and ran a line through Martinez's name. Pedro, to the coach's best assumption, was done. Underneath Martinez's scratched-out name, Wallace wrote Embry. Alan Embry, a left-handed pitcher, would start the 8th to match up against Nick Johnson, a left-handed hitter, and the first Yankee due up in the inning. Wallace and Corenti congratulated Martinez.